Well, I told Sid that I had a long sermon. He didn't tell me that he was going to preach his own little sermon for the commissioning. But here we go. We're going to continue our series looking through the entire story of the Bible. We're going to walk through these arrows. And this morning, we're going to look at creation, the very first arrow, God creating the world. And I'd actually like to read the whole first chapter of the Bible, the beginning of our story. And if you're able, and if you've heard the story before, do your very best to imagine this being your first hearing. And allow it to hit you as though you've never heard the story before. This is how we engage the very beginning of our story. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. There was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water." So God made the vault and separated the water under the vault from the water above it. And it was there so. God called the vault sky, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear." And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and gathered the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to the various kinds." And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seeds according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seeds in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark the seasons and days and years, and let them be lights in the vault of the sky to give light to the earth." And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. There was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the vault of the sky." So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living and moving thing with which the waters teem according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the water of the seas and let the birds increase on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, the ground, the wild animals, and each according to its kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make human beings in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and over the livestock and all the wild animals, over the creatures and all creatures that move along the ground." So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth, and all the birds in the sky, and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. That's how our story begins. And for some of you, maybe that was the first time hearing the whole first chapter of Genesis read aloud. If you're a lover of literature, or if you're a lover of film, you'll know that the beginning of every story matters. It sets the plot, it sets the stage for everything that is going to unfold from that point. This past Thursday, I was at a meeting at the church, and I came home from that meeting, and Brittany was watching some crime mystery drama. And I did what no husband should do. I sat down on the couch near the end of it and tried to figure it out with her. After about 10 seconds of watching, I started asking piles of questions. Who is that character? Why are these people not talking to each other? Where is this all taking place? And why is that person showing up in strange ways? And I successfully ruined this murder mystery for Brittany. But I was doing what we often do with the Bible. I stepped in midway through, I stumbled my way around, and I had no idea where it was starting, where it was going, and I just was living in confusion and also ruining her show. That's what we do with the Bible. Not realizing this is where it begins, this is how the plot starts, and this sets the drama forward in motion. I want to begin by saying just a couple words about Genesis as a whole. We're preaching on it this Sunday, we're preaching on it next Sunday as Sid opens up rebellion in God's good creation. Genesis feels sometimes, at least for pastors, like a powder keg. And by that I mean almost every verse in Genesis 1 and especially Genesis 3 is shrouded and surrounded in controversy and debate. You ever notice that? If you grew up in the church, all the questions surrounding the beginning of the world. How do we read this literature? What kind of literature is it? What genre is it? History or myth? Is this 6 literal days or is this longer? How do we reconcile what we hear in the scientific community and things about evolution with what we're reading in the scriptures? And on the debates go. And these are important discussions. Don't hear me understating them for a second. The downside to this is I've heard youth who've grown up in the church say, I don't even want to think about Genesis 1. It's just so full of controversy. I've heard pastors say to me, I don't want to preach on Genesis 1 because it's going to create tension in my church. And it feels to me sometimes a little bit like, picture 2 people standing in front of the Mona Lisa, this stunning piece in the Louvre. And there they are in front of it, but they're not looking at it. They're actually debating about it. When did Michelangelo begin it? How did he craft it? What was shaping it? When did it really come to its completion? And in all their debate, they never stop and engage the beauty of that piece. Sometimes that's how I feel about Genesis. And what we want to do in this sermon, in this series, is engage the beauty and the richness of the beginning of our story. Does that sound good? Well, it sounds good to me, so here we go. Genesis was written in all likelihood by Moses. And I say in all likelihood because they never said signing off Moses. But it is a very strong reason to think he wrote that. And it's written not to us, but to Israelites, to an ancient people who just came out of 400 years of slavery in Egypt. That is to say, they were steeped for 4 entire centuries in an Egyptian way of life, Egyptian cultural practices, and Egyptian religion. And Genesis is trying to say to this slave nation that just got freed, this is who you are. This is who your God is, the one that just rescued you from slavery. This is who he is. And this is the backstory of how we got to be where we are. This is the beginning. Now, Genesis, in my estimation, is not to be read as just another description of history. It's not to be read as just trying to tell us something. It's more than that. Genesis is an argument. Did you know that? There's been a lot of study done on ancient Near Eastern religions and ancient Near Eastern civilizations. People have studied Egyptology and the Mesopotamians and the Canaanites, and you know what? Those cultures all have their own stories. They all have their own accounts of how the world came into being and how the gods interact with it and the purpose of humanity. And this story, we're reading Genesis, all scholars will agree, it's interacting with those stories. But it's doing more than that. It's arguing with those stories. It's saying to the Egyptians and the Canaanites and the Mesopotamians and all the rest, this is the actual account of what happened. This is the true story of where we've come from, who we are, and who God really is. It's taking a stand against those stories saying, this is the true account. It's a bold, bold passage. And one small illustration I want to give to you of how it's interacting with other cultures is in day 4 of creation. This is small but highly instructive. God is putting the sun and the moon and the stars in the sky. He's giving light to his world. And we're told in Genesis 1 that it's the greater light, the sun, and the lesser light, the moon. And for us, that just sounds good. You give that passage to an Egyptian at the time, they drop the document and say, "What? That's blasphemy." Because for Egyptians, the sun was a god. The moon was a god. They're not just lights. They're to be revered and worshipped and have power over you. And Moses, writing Genesis, is saying to these slaves who came out of Egypt, they're beautiful. They're necessary. God created them. But don't worship them. Worship God. This is an argument for who we are, who God is, and why we exist. Now, Genesis is not a modern document. It's an ancient document written by an ancient person in an ancient context to an ancient people. That is to say, it will not answer all the modern questions that we bring to it. And we do bring a lot of modern questions to Genesis, particularly the how questions. How was it formed? How was the process unfolded? How do we bring what we know now and understand it and reconcile it to the passage? And as one really wise scholar said, as he examines Genesis, he says, perhaps we need to start listening to the questions that Genesis is asking. And could it be that those are not just different, but they are better and deeper questions? Questions of who and why and what is the purpose and function of this world we live in? That's what this passage is so incredibly preoccupied with. And so that's what we're going to look at. The questions and the answers that Genesis itself is interested in. Like any good story, this story begins by introducing the main character at the outset. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I could preach a whole sermon on that sentence, and I will try not to. In the beginning, God created. If you were to give that to the Israelites who just came out of slavery, there's a lot of stuff that would stand out to them immediately. First of all, it says God, not gods. There is one God who created the world. In Egypt, all the gods were very significant, very important, very powerful, but they were embedded in the world. They were part of the creation. Moses is saying here, God is separate from the creation, and it comes out of him. He is the source of creation. This is brand new for any Egyptian, any slave formed by that culture. This is big. This is a sovereign God. This is an uncreated God. This is a God who has a power over the entire creation. This is a whole different God than Egypt told them about. A number of years ago, when I was leading a Bible study with international students, most of whom were Chinese and Japanese and did not have any history with the Bible, we'd go through Genesis 1 together and we'd ask one question. What is this passage teaching us about the character of God? And I loved listening to these students, engaging Genesis 1, reading it, being curious about it, and then sharing their reflections. What is it teaching you about God? And they always shared, first of all, how big God seems, how he created, but also creating with effortless power. A number of students said, he just speaks, and the world is formed. He just speaks, and he crafts and fashions the creation. It's this effortless account of creativity and power. But secondly, and I've already mentioned this, for many of these students who are shaped by Eastern religions, they were stunned by how this God is far above the creation. Eastern religions often will mix God with creation to be participating in the world, is participating in God. And this account is a God who is above, beyond, and the source of the creation. And that is to say, as we discussed, they highlighted how this was a powerful God, a sovereign God, a creative God, working, creating God, and a relational God. All this is right in Genesis 1 in the introduction to the story. There's a scholar named Herman Bovink. Already in the 50s, he wrote this about the creation account and God's character, and I really like this. In this passage, the writer does not want us just to simply be introduced to another deity. He wants us all to encounter personally the living and true God. And Moses is saying, this is who you worship. This is the one true God. Uncreated, creative, powerful, relational. This is the real God. Now, after introducing us to the main character and that this character is the creator, Moses introduces us to the creation itself. And the image that I like of Genesis 1 as it unfolds is that of a craftsman shaping and crafting and putting sort of beautiful contours to the world in which we live, separating the light from the darkness, filling this world and making all these beautiful spaces that interact, vegetation and plant life, and then, of course, in day 5 and 6, filling the world with animals, and finally and climactically with people. If you notice closely how this narrative works, you'll notice that there's a shift and even a slowing down of the story as it gets to the creation of humanity. So far it says, let there be, let there be, let there be, let there be, let us create human beings in our own image. So God created human beings in his own image. Male and female, he created them. And I could preach another sermon on just this passage, and I'll try not to. But I'll say a few words about just how powerful this is. First of all, in other creation accounts, did you know that humanity doesn't play a big part? Humanity, in many other creation accounts, is sort of this lower being. There's the gods up here who have these important lives and interaction, and the humans actually serve a lower function. They're finite. They're a bit powerless. They're kind of a slave to the gods. And they're viewed as those who are just in charge of feeding the gods and worshiping the gods. How different this story is from those stories, where God is slowing down and saying, let us make these humans in our own image to reflect the goodness and the beauty and the creativity and the character of God himself. One more comparison. This is going to be a long sermon. Just buckle up, okay? In other creation accounts, there's often a temple being built. And that temple will have the image of a certain deity that people will worship, and they'll bring their worship in, they'll bring food for that god, and as they see the image in the temple, they'll worship that god. And people look at Genesis and they say, where's the temple in this creation account? You know where it is? It's the whole creation. In Genesis 1, the entire creation is the dwelling place of God. And then the question is, okay, where's the image of that god? It's humanity. As people see human beings, flesh and blood, men and women, they see the image bearers of the one true, uncreated, eternal, and sovereign God. Isn't that powerful? What a story that would be to these Israelites. You are not just slaves to the gods. You're not just this insignificant, insubordinate, lower being. That doesn't matter. You are the image bearers of the King of creation. And you are blessed by the Creator. You can't read Genesis 1 without seeing something that punctuates the whole narrative, and that is, it is good. God looks at the separation of light and darkness. It's good. He looks at the way in which he forms and fills and fashions the world, and at every point he says, it is good. At the end, when he creates man and woman and looks back at the entirety of his creation, God saw all that he had made, we read, and it was very good. This creation is not some cosmic war zone. It's not some insignificant place. It's one that's crafted into perfection and beauty. And God's declaration over the whole of it is good. I'm going to belabor this point this morning because I think we easily overlook it. The material world in which we live and we do all of our life is a good world. The flesh and blood that you and I have, our sight, our hearing, our touch, all the senses and experience of being human are good. God's declaration over bodily existence, the body in which you've been given and you live, is good. And I belabor this because within the church, there's often this teaching that we should actually live at a distance from our material creation. And that the bodies in which we live are actually bodies that we want our souls to escape and then go to some other ethereal heavenly realm. Genesis stands against that kind of teaching, just so you know. And if this is confusing and new to you, we're going to come back to this throughout our series. That Genesis is saying, no, you were created good. You were created in the image of God. And that's how you were meant to be. Yes, when we die, we go to be with Christ. And we don't know everything about that. The Bible is actually quite unclear. But Genesis says the body is good. And the New Testament is preoccupied with resurrection and new creation, getting a new body in a new earth. The body is good. A number of years ago, I was driving. And I was listening to a country station, which is rare for me. I don't particularly love country. They all sound the same. But that's a different conversation. And I was listening to a song by Kenny Chesney, and I still don't know the name of this song. But here's the line that Kenny Chesney shares in the song that actually made me smile and pause. He writes, "Everybody wants to go to heaven, have a mansion high above the clouds. Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to go now." Isn't that interesting? And when I heard that for the first time, I was like, huh, he's putting his finger on something really significant. And what I think he's putting his finger on is, we've been told that the goal of our lives is to get out of these bodies, to get away from this material world, go up there, have a harp, have a mansion in the clouds, and worship forever. And there's a lot of people who say, okay, it's interesting, but if I had to go right now, would I? If I had to go like right now and leave everything here, would I go? And the answer is, maybe not. And what he's putting his finger on, I think, is that the reason we don't want to go to that kind of heaven is because there's so much of this that we love. We love so much of our daily experience, the gift of relationship, the gift of work, the gift of friendship, all that stuff. In fact, an image that I've been told of Genesis 1, and I think about this image a lot, and I try to teach my kids with this image. In Genesis 1, you have an image of a loving father who places his children in this stunning, beautiful, varied creation. And it's like he's rubbing his hands as a loving father, and he's looking at his children, and he's saying, oh, wait till they experience sunsets. They're going to love it. Wait till they experience mountains like they have in BC. Wait till they experience food and spices and wine. Oh, they're going to love it. Wait till they experience the gift of friendship and marriage and sex. They're going to love it. Wait till they experience literature and film and sports and play. They're going to love it. Wait till they experience steak. They're going to love it. The joy and the goodness of this creation is never something that is surprising to God. Did you know that? The stuff that you love the most about marriage and friendship and human relationship and all that you have in your life, you were meant to enjoy that. The good Father who formed and fashioned this world designed it to be enjoyed. Are you hearing me? Is this resonating with you? And he's not interested particularly in us just escaping from it because it's good and designed for our joy. And we are intended to delight in creation. There's a passage in Timothy, and I actually want to read this passage. This is so interesting. I mean, Paul and Timothy, he's getting upset. In fact, he speaks quite strongly. Listen to what Paul says. This is a strong passage. He says, the Spirit clearly says that in later times, some will abandon the faith and follow deceiving spirits and things taught by demons. Whoa. Their consciences will be seared like a hot iron. They are hypocritical liars. Did you hear that? That's as strong as it gets. They've left the faith. They're following deceiving teaching, teaching by demons. Their consciences are seared with hot irons. What in the world are they teaching? Paul, tell us. What is this terrible, terrible teaching? You know what it is? These people are forbidding marriage, and they're telling people not to eat certain food. Whoa, Paul. It's going a little overboard. Now let's hear why Paul said it. He writes, "Which God created all these things to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and who know the truth. For everything God created is good." That is a powerful teaching. That is profound teaching. God don't make junk, and God don't junk what he makes. This is a good world to be delighted and enjoyed. And I know, you're probably thinking, Dave, you're a little bit out of touch with the reality of our world because when I look around, it's pretty broken. My work is difficult. My kids are difficult. Family is difficult. Relationships are difficult. There's a lot of sin and brokenness. And I mean, even this morning in our prayer, a drunk driver hitting a teenage student. That is an awful story. And next week, Sid's going to walk us through just how messed up and broken and sinful our world is. Brace yourself. It's a great sermon. But let me tell you already in advance of next week, that even in the face of the worst of our sin and the corruption in the world, underneath all of it is the beautiful, good creation. And we as believers who know the true story need to see that underneath all the muck and the mar of sin, the shining of the beauty of God and His goodness still shines through. For example, alcohol is a good gift of creation. Drunkenness twists that. And that's what leads to stories like a teenager getting struck by a drunk driver. That's not how it's supposed to be. Marriage and sex are a good gift of creation. Pornography twists that into something so destructive and ruining of families and marriages. On and on we could go. The goodness of creation, meant to be delighted, twisted by sin and corrupted in a direction it was never meant to go. But underneath all the sin, the creation is still good. And God's desire is to heal and redeem the whole of it. And if I could sit down with Kenny Chesney, what I would say to him is, what if I told you, Kenny, that God's purpose isn't to extract us and bring us to a mansion in the heavenly realms, but to heal the entirety of His world that is declared good? So we've been introduced to the main character, that is God. We've been introduced to this stage, this huge, beautiful creation in which we live. We've been introduced to the fact that we as humans are central figures in the biblical story. Now for the really important question that matters in this story, why in the world are we here? What is the purpose of humanity beyond just delighting in the creation? What are we here for? Listen to what we read at the end of Genesis 1. God blessed them, humanity, and He said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and every living thing that moves on the ground. Did you hear that? In our tradition, if you've never heard this, this is called the creation mandate. And I always chuckle because the creation mandate means go and have babies. Check plus to Hope Community Church. Fill the earth. Build cities. Develop culture. Spread out. Fill the earth. Subdue it, cultivate it, find out how it works, draw out the potential. Our tradition has done a ton of work on this phrase of subdue it, and there's been a lot of discussion about what that means. And I believe the most faithful way of reading subdue is drawing forth the potential that God packed into this world. And here's what I mean by that. When we marvel at this creation account, we should not just marvel at what was made, but what hasn't been made yet. God did not finish this thing in its full, complete form. That's not the case. The story of the Scriptures begins with a garden and it ends with a city. And God places humanity in creation to draw out all the incredible potential to develop and cultivate and enjoy all these different things in His world. One small example to put some pegs on this. My brother Sean lives in Ontario. He makes maple syrup, the best thing in the world. It takes forever to make. Did you know that 60 liters of sap makes 1 liter of maple syrup? That's why it's expensive. Unless, of course, you enslave your family to making it for you, then it gets a lot cheaper, like Sean does. Different story. But think about this for one moment. God makes a certain kind of tree called the maple tree. And my parents have a lot of them in the forest behind their house. And He knew that in certain conditions, like in Ontario, it gets cold in the night and then it warms up in the spring, that there's a sap in that tree that moves up and down as it gets cold and warm. And God wasn't surprised when someone put a little spigot in the side of that tree and something called sap flowed out of that tree. And then people, as they saw this sap, they realized, oh, it's pretty tasty. We should boil it. And then people discover that if you boil it at a certain degree for a certain length of time, the most delicious liquid you've ever put on your tongue is what comes out of it. Now here's the question. Do you think God was surprised when the first batch of maple syrup was slowly being poured into a metal container? Not in the least. That's one small example of drawing out the incredible potential and developing creation. If you just pause and look around this building, every single piece of thing you see is an illustration of the way in which we are cultivating and subduing creation. These walls, drywall, all, what are they even made of? I'm the wrong person for this. The stuff behind them, the electrical, the floor, whatever that's made of, these chairs, the fabric, the metal, the lights, the technology, all of that is the developing and the cultivating of the creation. And that was all there, the potential for it, in the creation account. And God says to this creation, He says to His humanity, develop it. Cultivate it. subdue this world. Enjoy it as stewards of the earth that I own. And Sid might talk about this next week, but know that this was not a world that was meant to be subdued and developed in a way that destroys creation and hurts relationship and brings destruction and pain. That's our purpose. Develop creation, delight in this world, build cities, and flourish as families. That's a pretty good beginning to a story. The word that many writers use when they look at Genesis 1 is shalom. And I really like that word. The beginning of our story is not cosmic warfare like other stories. It's not some accidental coming together of things and atoms. It is an intended shalom. This beautiful creation that God intended for us. And the purpose was that humans would live in perfect relationship with the Father. Perfect relationship with one another. Perfect relationship with the creation around us. And even perfect relationship with ourselves. There was no hatred. There was no violence. There was no dangerous grudges. There was no greed. All of it was in perfect shalom. How does that sound as you think about where our story begins? As I think about, I've been reflecting on Genesis 1 this week, I thought to myself, what a beautiful beginning. And as we walk through the rest of the story, as we look through the fall, the calling of Israel, and the arrival of Jesus, we learn over and over again that the work of Christ in his death and his resurrection was not just the healing of human hearts, not just the forgiveness of sins, although it is definitely those things. It is the reclaiming of the entire cosmos and making all things new. And when you notice this, when you start paying attention to God's love and his concern for his good world, you realize that in Ephesians and Colossians, for example, it always talks about what Jesus has done in these huge terms, that he is the head over all things, that all things are reconciled together in Christ. And it's not just talking about humans, it's talking about the whole world being brought back into shalom. And one way we can talk about the Christian faith is that as we come to Christ, as we experience his renewal work in our life, as we experience the power of the Holy Spirit, that shalom is coming into our lives. As the kingdom breaks into us, the putting back together of life enters into our lives. And you see this, if you're a pastor, you see when people come to Christ and they experience the renewing work of Christ, as they repent of their sins and experience him doing his work, all of a sudden the relationships change. Marriages change. Families change. Work changes. And what you notice is the shalom that was intended from the beginning and what will be at the end, breaking into the present. And let me tell you, that is a powerful witness to the true story. When the Church of Jesus Christ experiences the shalom through the work of Christ and the indwelling work of the Holy Spirit. This is how the story begins. A good world created by a powerful, sovereign, uncreated, loving, relational Father to be developed, cultivated, and enjoyed. Let's pray.